This chance to speak to you about this work. In fact, this work is related to the previous talk. I mean, it's one can say this is a following work after the one that was that the previous speaker has just now given. So this is also a joint work with Rolf Kuhn, Constrained Lifting. Yeah, that's okay, but I wanted something else actually. I wanted, okay. Okay, anyway. Okay, so I also speak about the row contractions. Row contractions is a tuple of operators, T1 up to TD. All these operators on the single Hilbert are the bounded operators on a single Hilbert space, H, and they satisfy this condition, summation Ti, Ti star is less than or equal to identity. When they are considered as a row of operators, then you can just write it in short, like T underline star is less than or equal to identity. Okay, and some of the definitions you have already seen in the previous talk. So coisometric would be when this less than or equal to is when T star is equal to identity as a row contraction. Okay. In this context, okay. So given a row contraction, there exists a minimal isometric dilations that was in, given by Popescu. So like for a single contraction, there exists a minimal isometric dilation and unitary dilations also given by Nas Suez, and this Popescu's construction is analogous to the Sapir construction way of getting that dilation for the row tuples, and it's very useful. And in fact, in this work also and the previous work, we have very much used this construction. And there is another popular way of dilating a row contraction. I mean, when the row contraction consists of operators which are commuting, then you have a commuting dilations, which was studied by Arveson and Dury. We'll call it standard commuting dilations. This also. And other than that, there are some constrained dilations also. The constraint is introduced due to a some polynomial relations. So this constraint dilations were studied by Raja Bhatt, Popescu, Zacharias, and myself. We'll talk about what kind of constraint dilations are later. So, okay, so. This constraint, I want to define what that means. So it's through a polynomial relations. So you have a set of polynomials, P eta, on n variables, non-commuting variables. So this set is indexed by J. Then your tuple T is said to be J constraint if this tuple is zero of this polynomial. So in this way, a constraint is introduced on the tuples. I mean, if the tuples satisfy this this polynomial, then are zeros of this polynomial, then they are said to be J constrained. So given any row contraction, you can get hold of a piece of it in the left hand corner here, where it satisfies this polynomial constraint relation. So it is given in this way. So if you have a row contractions on a Hilbert space L, then there always exists a maximal subspace because of one can argue it, and so that the our operators leave this space co-invariant, and the top left hand corner is the maximal space on which they satisfy this constraint relations that is given here, and we call this particular piece that is at the corner here as the maximal J constraint piece. The star is any some non-zero entry here, and this is the thing that is appearing in the right hand corner, anything, but we denote it because we will use it later. One of the things, why do J constrain? Like in certain cases it becomes very useful, like when, for example, in commuting case, the J constrain gives you proper analyticity. Like in the previous lecture you saw that the characteristic function was a kind of analogous to H infinity function, but it was only analogous. But when you have the constraint inducing the commuting relations, then you'll have a classical H infinity function as the as the characteristic function. So makes sense to introduce constraint, particularly in the classic, in the commuting case. And also you can have in other cases also, you can see it will be pretty useful. Okay, so there are three special kinds of constraints. The first one here, you see the PIJs are given by ZJ minus ZJ ZI. So this is clear that it introduces commuting relations. The second one induces Q commuting relations, where QIJs are assumed to be mod 1 and QIJ is equal to inverse of QJI. Okay, this is the indexing set, it's clear. And here the third one induces what is called as something like Kunz-Krieger relations. So you have the relations here ZIZJ minus AIJ ZIZJ, where AIJ is the A equal to AIJ is a 0-1 matrix. So at least one entry to be 1 in each row and each column, and others can be zeros. So this induces Kunz. So these three are very special in some sense. So we will call it, we'll see why these are special also. In case we are dealing with the constraint J, which is of the case 1 type, then we'll always denote it by JS. And when they are combination of all those three, then we'll denote it by J dash. And in general, will be just J. Okay, this is just notations. Yeah. And I repeat again the definition of lifting that you saw last time. It is nothing but your E is said to be lifting of C on this Hilbert space if E leaves HC to be co-invariant. That's why the zero comes here. That's just lifting. Okay, so minimal constraint dilations. First of all, a notation that we denote by V the minimal isometric dilations of T. I will write mid for minimal isometric dilations. One of the results from our previous work, I mean not the last work but previous, in set of three papers, I mean I combine the result here. It is that if T is a J dash constraint, that is a combination of the three, if T is J dash constraint already, then the J dash constraint piece of the minimal isometric dilation is given by when you have this superscript J dash, it means the maximal constraint piece of the minimal isometric dilation V is the minimal J constraint dilation of T. So in a way, as a piece of the minimal isometric dilation, you can get the constraint dilation. That's what it means. Okay, but here the tuple itself was assumed to be J constraint. The question is, when the tuple is not assumed to be J constraint, when the row contraction is not assumed to be J constraint, then is it true that if you take the J constraint piece of the original tuple and then the J constraint piece of the dilation, minimal isometric dilation, does this dilation become a constraint dilation of the other one? Not. This was already answered in some sense in the previous works. Here are some more answers. I mean, this result of, okay, theorem 2 actually uses some of Davidson's result, one of his lemma in, okay, Davidson, Cripps and Spiegel paper. This it uses this paper's result. So it says that if it's only in the finite dimensional case, so if H is finite dimensional and co-isometric, then the maximal commuting piece, that is that J, that is contained inside H itself, the original one, and thereby it has a positive answer to this question, that is constraint, it's really the constraint dilation, standard commuting dilation, I mean, in this case. There is another result, theorem 4, which will give another positive answer to this question in a different setup. Before that, I need to introduce this definition of subisometric, which you have already seen again. Yeah, subisometric. Okay, E is said to be subisometric lifting of C if there is a unitary which intertwines between the minimal isometric dilations of E and C. Of course, keeping identity on C part. So just repeat it. Okay, a corollary of the previous thing is that because the maximal J piece comes in H, therefore the constant pieces of E and C both coincide. In fact, okay, trivial corollary. The thing is four. You see another positive answer of this question that I asked. In case the TN part is, I mean, this part is N, no? So yeah. So if this N part is star stable, that is star stable was defined last time. This is defined in this way: limit of summation of A alpha star is equal to zero. So since the CP map goes to zero, that is introduced. Okay. So if TN is star stable and is coisometric, then it has a positive answer to the previous question. That is, the J constant here and the J constant there is in fact related by the minimal constant dilation. Okay, this was some of the positive answers to the question in the constraint case. So you see, these are in all the three constraint, special constraint case it works. Of course, not for the other ones, so they are special in that sense also. Okay, now we come to the characteristic functions. In the previous talk again, I will be keeping referring to the previous talk because it is a short talk and I will not define everything again. Okay, but you saw in the last talk that when E is a constant lifting of C, E is a contractive lifting of C, then there exists a contraction gamma between the defect spaces. That contraction gamma was there. So that is of course there here also when E is a lifting. I mean, of course, I just recall it here. And when is a tuple called completely non-coisometric? When this space H1A is zero, where H1A is the space on which A acts as coisometry. So that the space on which it acts as a coisometry, that space is zero. And reduced lifting, as defined before, when the A part is CNC, non-coisometric, and in fact gamma is resolving. I'll not define resolving, so better in a little less general setting. Injective is a special case of resolving. So okay, so it's reducing when reduced when it's CNC and injective. Yeah, and the Fock space on CD is given by gamma. It is the C on the vacuum plus CD plus CD tensor twice up to CD tensor n and so on. And this has been repeated in all the previous talk also. The creation operator given by Li, which gives a EI, tensor EI before this element. So it creates an element here. It's a shift operator where EI denotes the standard basis, canonical basis of CD. And this Popescu's construction, which I talked about before, looks in this way, right? If H is the element of the original space and this is the Fock space tensor D, the defect space, this part, then you have a TI on the first part of it, and then you have this kind of B part, which is vacuum tensor DTI component, and then you have a shift on the rest of the part. Okay. Yeah. So I need something called pseudo J constant dilations, which will be like on. So you see here the thing is H plus gamma tensor DT. On the gamma tensor DT, one should introduce the constraint it to the J Fock space. Then you have H direct sum gamma J tensor CD. So ST is defined to be the, is taken to be the constraint, is taken to be the compression of the Popescu's realization of the minimal isometric dilation to this space, which is a subspace, and this will be called a pseudo J dilation. This is important for getting the formula of the characteristic function. Then if one checks, one finds that there exists a unitary between this follows because of, one has to go through the minimal isometric direction come down, like use the framework of the previous arguments, previous talk. So then you have a unitary intertwining between SC and SC plus another tuple Z. You have a unitary between intertwining between them. And as before, if you restrict this unitary to the Fock spaces on two sides on this, then I define this part as the constraint characteristic function. As I told you, yeah, so here you have, for the commuting case, you will have the commuting Fock space, and then it will become this classical H infinity function. Okay, this is, yes, so this is multi-analytic in that sense. Yes, yeah, one can further argue in the same way that you can define the defect operator to be delta, denote the defect operator to be delta of the characteristic function. Then in fact the space on the space related to our pseudo J constant dilation denoted by KJ can be written in this form. You see this form, this in this way you can describe the entire HE and KJ completely in terms of the characteristic function and the Fock space. And because of this structure, it follows that our characteristic function is a complete invariant for constant reduced liftings also. It's not very difficult to argue these things. I mean, it's once the argument is done for the general setting, one can come down to this constraint setting. And okay, now we'll discuss some of the invariants of Hilbert modules. Hilbert modules was introduced by Arveson, and in the commuting when the tuple of operators commuting, and along with two invariants were introduced, curvature invariant and Euler characteristic. And Cripps and Popescu independently have a general version, as have a version for non-commuting ones. The commuting ones has more advantages in the sense that it also has to do with the geometry of this. Yeah, but as an invariant, even the non-commuting one gives a very nice invariant. Okay, so we'll see that our characteristic function is also related to this invariants in some way. So for that, crucial is this last equation. We can derive this last equation independently is very crucial, and that will be useful to give the relation between the characteristic function and the curvature invariant also. But as such, this is itself important, because in few works, I don't know, it's important. Okay, okay, so how to get this? I mean, from the equation 1 and 2, the structure of the previous page that I showed, this 2, 1 and 2 here, one can easily derive these two equations where m not j, oh god, where m not j is the Poisson kernel, and here is the project p denotes the projection onto the w h e part. Then you, okay, from the previous two equations you can get this kind of equation and also this equation very easily. And once you compare these two equations, you can replace this term by using the first one, and you can get hold of the equation 3. Once you have the equation 3, then it's very easy to relate the invariants of the Hilbert module with our characteristic functions. Okay, how is the Hilbert module defined? So you have free semigroup algebra denoted by CF n plus. Then for every row contraction E, and Hilbert left module is associated, given by this, that when G is taken to be from the free semigroup algebra and H is taken from the Hilbert space HE, then G acts on H as given here. I mean, it replaces the variables by the operators and acts on it. And when E is assumed to be contractive, row contraction, then you automatically have this relation. So this is a contractive Hilbert module. We assume further that rank of DC is finite in this section. Then the well-known invariance given by Cribbs and Popescu in non-commutative case, which is written here, is as follows. The curvature invariant is given by TR, a trace of K star A, where K star A is the, K A is the, denote the Poisson kernel of A. And this is the projection onto the space generated by particle spaces less than or equal to N, I mean, tensored identity. So it is trace, Poisson kernel star, projection onto this particle spaces, and K Poisson kernel again divided by this, and the Euler characteristic is given by this formula. And okay, I am just quoting here the old formula. So in those papers it has also been argued that limit exists and these things are well defined, of course. Yes, now using the equation 3 that was there, equation 3 was this last one. If you use this equation 3, then these two formulas get converted into this. This is quite easy to see. You have to just replace, you have to transfer the KA from this side to left hand side, because it's trace, it gets done, and then you can replace K, K star by using the formula 3 by I minus M theta characteristic function, and it's easy to get this. So now you see, okay, so by using the formula 3, you can get theorem 6, these two new formulas, and here you can clearly see that our characteristic function given by MCE and M is related to the curvature invariant of Cribbs and Popescu, and also the Euler characteristic here is related to our characteristic function. So this is without constraint, this is in the complete non-commutative case. Yeah. Okay, this formulas, similar formulas can be developed only, I mean, we have the proof of these things only in the case of without any constraint, or in the commuting case, in the constraint which induces commuting case. And in the commuting case, it turns out to be this particular formula. Of course, this is the Avicen's form, using the Avicen's formula, and using the same kind of equation. Okay, so equation 3 was even with the constraint, so you can have the commuting constraint and you can get hold of this kind of formula here. The same replacement you have to do, where RK stands for the rank and TR stands for the stress trace, and this is the Euler characteristic, it will get converted into this, and thereby you can see that the our characteristic function, constraint characteristic function, is related to the curvature invariant and Euler characteristics as given here. Yeah, that's it.
Any questions or comments? Yeah, just have a general comment and question. I've never thought very much about the non-commutative case, so I don't know what the motivating underlying questions might be. But in the commutative case, the examples come from algebraic varieties,
yes,
and vector bundles,
yes,
or more generally sheaves over algebraic varieties. Okay, so if you have a sheaf or a vector bundle over an algebraic variety, and you take the module of sections, of algebraic sections of that, then you have a finitely generated module, and you bring in Hilbert space norms, make your operators to satisfy the appropriate conditions. So you can define a Hilbert polynomial, for example, which contains the Euler characteristic and higher and other characteristics.
As the coefficients.
Information too. So my question is, okay, that's my statement.
Yeah.
My question is, now that you've got this multivariable characteristic operator function, it seems to me that you might be able to use that itself to get information about the sheaf or the algebraic variety. For example, can you calculate the Hilbert polynomial from the characteristic operator function? Or can you reconstruct, if it's a vector bundle, can you reconstruct the vector bundle from just looking at the properties of the characteristic operator function?
First thing is, I have not yet looked into these things. Yes. But I should also say that this last section about the characteristic function relations doesn't say much actually, because in a way the gamma gets cancelled because it's assumed to be isometry, and it basically depends on A part, doesn't much depend on the C and E part. So I'm not very sure if it can give more information about the lifting. It will give similar information which already gives for the A part, which is already well studied. But one can, yeah. So I don't know, one should look at it. I don't know how much information one can get out of it. Maybe one can get out of, so I have not seen it, but.
I'm not too familiar with the multivariable characteristic function, but in the Naj class, you know, the stuff everyone knows,
yes.
The characteristic function completely determines the operator, so it completely determines the module.
Yes.
And so it's all there, all the information is there. And I'm just assuming a similar thing. If the similar thing is here, then you might have a message to give the algebraic geometry.
Yes, I think it.
That'd be nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, surely one should try to do this, and yeah, maybe will be my next project. Yes.
Okay, that's a good point. I don't know the answer to the question, but in the non-communicative case, one reason that this is probably the case is that you have to have a maybe in problem is that this is really the curvature, is an invariant of the CP map, not really of the whole contraction.
Yeah.
It can be done for any CP map of a semi-finite vector.
It must be there. So our message to the algebraic geometry is, I mean, Joey's asking, so what is a non-commutative variety? Here's our answer. It's a completely positive map.
Are there any other questions? Thank you, Peter, once again.